today's main course is brought to you by Franny's and Brooklyn Larder, working hard to make the food in Brooklyn locally sourced, sustainable, and delicious. Find out more at franniesbrooklyn.com and bklarder.com.
Wow, special thanks to Franny's for sponsoring this episode of The Main Course. I'm Patrick Martins. I'm broadcasting to you here on Sunday from Roberta's Restaurant, which is a restaurant in transformation. It's a cultural center that's constantly expanding and changing. It's more like a performance art piece than it is a restaurant. Well, I am alone. Usually The Main Course is hosted by Katie Kiefer and myself, so I'm all by myself. So this is basically what that means when I'm by myself. Oh, wait a second. I have some preparation stuff to talk about. I was read some interesting articles. These are my top three articles of the year. Big Food versus Big Insurance by Michael Pollan, where in that op-ed piece, he basically says that big food, that he basically says the insurance people who run the insurance firms do not lobby, on any agricultural committees because they have no real vested interest in keeping health food costs down, or healthcare costs down. But once, this Obama health initiative passes, even if it's one of the weaker versions of it, insurance companies are going to have to allot the same amount of money to every patient in the world, or every patient in America. What does that mean? It means that there are no more pre-existing condition excuses. They have to deal with everyone, and as a result, are going to have a vested interest in keeping people healthier, and are therefore going to start sitting on a lot of those agricultural committees to keep food healthy. So I really like that idea. I think that'll be good to have the insurance companies fighting for something good rather than fighting for something lame. Wah, wah. That's my sound effect. Then another one I like: at some schools, tastier trays come at a price. And that article in the Washington Post talked about Revolution Foods, which is a California-based company that actually provides 40,000 meals a day for school kids. And whereas the government allots about $2.70 a meal, I believe, or $2.90, or no, what does the school? The school gives about $2.70, and Revolution Foods is coming in just a few cents more. They're coming at like $3 a meal, which is not that much more than what the government allots anyway. So a shout out to Revolution Foods for doing something that matters. And one of the best ideas I heard, I've been thinking a lot about Michelle Obama's number one top priority, which is to improve school lunch, to make kids be eating better food. And one of the most exciting ideas I heard about that is this idea of partnering every public school in the country with a restaurant. And each restaurant would be responsible to basically work with the lunch lady. Once a month, they would have to send some, talented teacher-type character from their staff to work with the lunch lady. I think the biggest success from that strategy would be, portioning costs. Also, diversity of products, how to use other products that still fit under the USDA requirements. So anyway, very interesting. Partner the pirate ship captains, in the kitchens throughout the country, curing, working with meat, dealing with the fish guys, take them who are experts at food, and bring them to the lunch ladies who are also experts at food. And they've had to be experts in even tougher conditions, and to bring those people together to produce great food is amazing. I think if there is a lunch lady award, that the actual trophy that they get should be like a golden or platinum hairnet. That's what lunch ladies should get. Well, we are going to take a break and come back for a full on deep down look at the slaughterhouse world with Nick Fantasma. Stay with us. Here we are back on the main course, brought to you by Franny's. It's Sunday, that means it's the main course, and we're here with Nick Fantasma, an owner of Paradise Locker Meats Slaughterhouse in Trimble, Missouri. You with us, Nick?
How you doing, Patrick?
Hey, how's it going? Nice to talk to you under non-work related circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Nick Fantasma is the floor chief of Paradise Locker Meats, which does a lot of local work throughout the Kansas City area and also processes pigs for Heritage Foods, and is actually one of the people who I have come to respect the most in the food world after
well,
all
you.
These years. So,
thank you.
Nick, tell us, I have a few questions for you. You are our main guest for the day, and it's an honor to have you.
Honor to be here.
Why is there a slaughterhouse bottleneck in the United States?
I think it's a it's just becoming one of those lost arts that not a lot of kids that are growing up today are even aware of it. So it's just it's becoming an unknowledgeable field to some people. They don't know that kind of stuff exists anymore.
And, I mean, why is that? I mean, what is it about the work that makes it be, like, what's an example of an old art form? Like, well, you know, the shoemaker has gone out, but I'm trying to think of an old art form that still exists is, you know, like the leather worker. I mean, that guy still is around. I mean, what is it about slaughterhouse work that's made it easy to forget?
I think essentially just the convenience of the... and the availability of food in this country. You can go to a store and you can pick up your you can pick up clothes that you need and oil for your car and food for your dinner table at the same place, and that's not how it used to be. There was certain places that you went to get good quality food and separate stores and local shops that dealt specifically with one area, and the industrialization of the food system in this country has just made it abundantly more convenient for people, but at the same time, they've lost the quality of what the food was originally intended for.
But now, doesn't the food at the you know, at the gas stations and at the big supermarkets also come through a slaughterhouse?
Yes, but it's done in such a high quantity now that the personal attention can't be put to what they do, like what we do.
So give us an example of the scale. I mean, a big industrial slaughterhouse versus what you guys do. I think you guys call yourselves a custom slaughterhouse. Is that right?
Yeah, we are a USDA custom slaughterhouse, meaning so anyone can bring us a beef or a hog or a lamb, and we will cut it up to specifically that person's instructions, based on a weekly supply of us, a weekly output of us. We're looking, you know, maybe 140 to 150 hogs and 10 to 12 beef, and maybe 10 lamb on top of that. Whereas commercial slaughterhouses run in thousands a day.
Were those slaughterhouses once like yours?
I believe, you know, all slaughterhouses started out as small. There wasn't when the country was settled and cities were formed up, there was small specific spots that handled food for that community, and that handled the slaughtering for that community. Mm-hmm. And now there's places that are halfway across the country that supply your grocery store with food. It's become a nationwide level, which on a certain circumstance is good, but the quality aspect in the commodity market or in the industrialized market hasn't came with the quantity.
Now, can you pinpoint where the loss of quality happens once you jump to that big? Like, as those guys grew from your size to, you know, being one of six slaughterhouses that, you know, processes all the meats in America, you know, with a minor exception, you know, what can you pinpoint what gets lost?
I think essentially the biggest point that gets lost is how the animals are raised. Because that's a big part of meat quality is how the animals are raised, how the animals are treated, and then in turn, you know, on our end, on how the animals are slaughtered. And when you get into, I'm not saying that the big slaughterhouses don't have a strict program just like we do, because they fall under USDA and have to follow the same guidelines that we do.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get into a commercialized market of doing that many animals a day and working on quotas rather than waiting until the animals are actually ready, you know, there's certain things that would just fall through the cracks as far as, you know, maybe this pig isn't quite the right weight or doesn't have as much fat or hasn't had the same amount of feed or something like that some of the other ones have, but mm-hmm. we need to get these numbers through, so.
Now, is it also must be a little bit of why there's a bottleneck is just the sheer amount of hard work that it takes to run a slaughterhouse. I mean, it is a physically demanding job, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's lots of heavy lifting, moving animals around, and we range from a lamb that weighs maybe 50 pounds to a beef that weighs 1,200 pounds. So there's a lot of actually hands on as far as our process goes, hands on of having to be able to move that meat and move those carcasses and handle those big pieces to break them down into the primal cuts and into the custom cuts.
Now, do you have machinery that lessens this load, or are there certain things that even machines cannot fix in terms of the heavy lifting?
As far as for the most part, you know, we're not lifting sides of beef anymore. Uh-huh. like we used to and 20 years ago. But you know, there's still a demand for lifting 80 to 100 pound shoulder clod off of a beef,
mm-hmm.
you know, moving it from the table over to the bandsaw where it can get further broken down.
How can we fix the problem? I mean, have you guys ever thought of a solution? I mean, if people come to you to try to learn the art, I mean, I know here in New York, we have a guy named Tom Milan who went up state and lived with a slaughterhouse called Fleischer's in upstate New York, and then came back and started a butcher shop and now some school that's going to teach people about, you know, cutting down and using whole animals. I mean, that's one way, but I mean, do you see a way of turning the tide so that more farms could have the incentive to raise food ethically, knowing that there's a slaughterhouse there to protect them?
I definitely think there's a means of doing it. You know, it's already kind of started with the almost rock star status that a lot of chefs are getting now, with the introduction of the Food Network and the popularity of those kinds of shows, Iron Chef, Hell's Kitchen, all that.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite show, by the way?
My favorite show, I don't know. I would have to say Iron Chef, probably. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So anyway, there's a celebrity cult status around these chefs.
And I think it's becoming more and more of a popular career to get into. There's a lot of younger kids, you know, even my age and younger, coming out of college that are excited about dealing with food. And the culture of my generation are growing up very aware of the problems with the food system in the country, of the poor quality of food, and realizing now of, you know, as with Heritage Foods' help, you know, being a big part of it, and Slow Food as well, raising awareness about better quality meat, and the old style of doing things has always been the better way. That it's getting to where there's a lot more need for it now. Now, on that end, that's already started, and that's great. What we really need is, you know, get the information out there, get some people excited about wanting to be on our side, on the raising and the slaughtering aspect of it. You know, and it's just by education, as far as I'm concerned, you know, getting the word out, letting people know that there is a better way to do things. Mm-hmm. You know, we've started it, we've shown that it can work, we've shown that there's definitely people in this country that are wanting that better quality product and not wanting to settle for store-bought meat or for commodity meats. So just getting the word out and getting more people like myself, you know, my generation, excited about it. And I see a lot of that happening. You know, we're members of the Missouri Meat Processors Association and the American Association of Meat Processors. And a few times a year, the Missouri Meat Processors get together, and I see a lot of you know, people that own other custom and USDA slaughter facilities in Missouri, their children are starting to get involved in their businesses. You know,
okay.
Their sons and their daughters are helping them run the place, and it's very exciting to me to be able to see other generations coming up like mm-hmm. me and my brother are. So it's definitely moving towards that area. I just think we, you know, if we can make it more of a nationwide network, you know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of stuff going on in the Midwest, but there's not too many farms and slaughterhouses out towards the coasts.
Isn't that funny? Because this is where all the good, I mean, a lot of the, you know, very expensive, sustainable foods are, you know, and yet
absolutely.
There's also not the infrastructure is where you are.
Absolutely, yeah. And which it's, you know, I definitely think that, you know, being in the Midwest is with the amount of slaughterhouses that we have now, there'd obviously have to be quite a bit more. But I think that it could definitely be a feasibly working food system for this country, with, you know, the farms bringing stuff from the farms to the Midwest to supply and process and be able to distribute. It's a good centralized location for the entire country, but at the same time, I think that if we want to do this on a nationwide level, we're going to have to get some more people out away from the Midwest involved in this kind of thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, there's one aspect which, of course, is not so exciting for a USDA-inspected slaughterhouse, which is the litany, or, I mean, this is a necessary evil, I might add, but all the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, regulations and paperwork that you guys have to push. Can you describe, like, what those are intended for and, like, what are you really doing when you say you have a million papers to file? For the USDA, what does that mean?
Essentially, what we have to do as part of a USDA inspected facility, we have to generate HACCP plans.
So, what does that stand for? HAACP? HAACP, right?
Yes, and
that's hazard analysis or something.
Yeah, hazard analysis and critical control points.
And critical control points. Okay.
And essentially what that is, it's set up in three different sections. The first section is a text-written plan or procedure, essentially.
Hold on. Wait a second. We are going to have to take a station break here. Look at Jack all socializing. Hey, we have our next guest here. But, Jack, did you get that first one? Oh, we have a call-in. That's what he's motioning to me about. Nick, you can't see this, but we have a call in.
All right.
Hold on. Oh, hello.
Hi, my name is Michelle. I'm calling from Delray Beach, Florida.
Oh, hey, Michelle. Thanks for calling in.
Well, I hope it's pretty cold there because it's 90 degrees here and I'm sitting in a pool with a bikini on.
Oh, my God. Very nice. I am not in a bikini and it's kind of cold here, but it's sunny.
You're not in a bikini? What are you wearing?
I'm wearing just, you know, blue shirt, blue pants. I am wearing man jellies, though, which are apropos to
like
your
clock?
Terroir. What's that?
Man jellies.
Yeah, they're like
you don't
those.
Have man boobs, do you?
No, I don't. Thank you. I'm not that old.
Okay, good.
So tell us, what's your question?
My question is, I am not a meat eater, but I know I should probably have a little bit of it. What would be the safest meat to eat?
Ooh, very good question. I will throw that to Nick, who's the expert. Nick, what is a safe meat to eat for someone who, you know, isn't really all about meat?
You know, I always tell people that I feel very comfortable in the fact that I know where my food comes from and the process that it goes through. Working at a slaughter facility and being able to process the things that I take home on a nightly basis makes me very comfortable about what I'm eating. You know, do some research about where you're purchasing your product. Where do they get their product from? Where, you know, do they process their own product? You know, what kind of stuff are they using?
So, Nick, are you saying that it doesn't really matter what cut as long as you know the source?
Absolutely.
Even if it's ground meat?
Even if it's ground, yeah. I don't have a doubt in my mind about any ground beef that I bring home because I know where it's come from and the process that it's gone through and how it was handled. Mm-hmm. You know, all meat is essentially, it starts out safe. When it's in a live animal form, it's safe to consume. The contaminations and the problems that occur with foodborne illnesses and stuff happen after that animal is slaughtered.
Right.
So
it happens at the processing facility like yours.
Exactly. It can happen at the processing facility, and it can happen at the distribution center as well. Mm-hmm. If the temperatures aren't properly controlled on where that meat is stored, or you know, how that box meat is handled.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, very interesting question. That was nice to get a call in. USDA regulations. You said it was a 5-step process, or 4-step.
With the HACCP plans that we create, because you're responsible for creating your own HACCP plans because it's your procedure for any specific process.
Like,
I have a HACCP plan for beef and pork slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
I have a HACCP plan for lamb slaughter. I have a HACCP plan for fresh, not ground processing, which would include everything as far on the processing floor besides ground meat.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a ground HACCP plan. I also have heat-treated cooking and fully cooked cooking HACCP plans.
Mm-hmm. So basically, is it for every single process that you do that's different?
Any process that's under USDA, we have to, because we have to generate a plan and a procedure for that process. And then once you have a text version of the HACCP plan, and then you have a flow chart of the HACCP plan, and then you have a charted diagram. And in each of these pieces of the procedure fall certain critical control points.
Mm-hmm.
Critical control points are areas that can, or parts of the process in which contamination is most likely to occur, or temperature variation would be most likely to occur,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
as far as processing goes. With slaughter, critical control points are a visual inspection of the carcass for any type of contaminations, whether that would be hair, feces, anything like that. In processing, our critical control points are temperature checks.
Mm-hmm.
On a daily basis, we have to take a temperature of any ground meat that we do and any not ground meat that we do. at a random time during the day. During the packaging stage, so that meat has traveled through the entire process and is ready to get packaged and go back into a cooler, we have to verify that that temperature of that meat has remained below a certain temperature to ensure that the meat hasn't started to sour. It's raised up above a certain temperature, above a food safe temperature. For a certain amount of time, bacteria starts to grow.
So basically, your HACCP plan is basically recording a series of temperatures officially via paper and computer, correct?
Depending on the process, yes. The processing and the cooking is all essentially temperature tests. On the slaughter aspect, it's visual checks. It's also temperature checks on our sanitation hoses that we use to sanitize the carcasses. That's another critical control point.
How do you do it?
Slaughter.
How do you follow all these things, and how much time does it take you? I mean, how much time of the overall week is dedicated towards just registering these information bits?
I would say almost probably less than 25%,
okay.
15 to 20%. I mean, it's not a lot, and you make it as part of a daily, you know, a daily routine and how we train our employees of the paperwork that we have to fill out. And it's not an intense amount during the day. What is an intense amount of is keeping track of it all, because we are subject every year to a yearly audit where USDA will come in and review our paperwork for the entire past year.
Okay.
And we have corresponding paperwork with from slaughter to process to if involved cooking, and we have to be able to tie all those together.
Very, very interesting. Well, now we're going into our rapid fire moment. That means rapid fire, Nick, right?
Alrighty.
So I'm going to, I'd like you to name three, give me a headline on three interesting cuts of beef. Like either, you know, from the slaughter perspective, like because it gives yields to a bunch of options on how they can be cut, or because they're challenging, or because they're particularly delicious, just for any reason. Give our listeners a lowdown, a quick lowdown on three interesting cuts of beef.
Three interesting cuts. I would say first would have to be a hanger steak.
Uh-huh.
It's a phenomenal piece of meat, very, very tender, very loose-grained, and is not used for a lot of movement in the animal. So it stays very tender. It's got an excellent flavor profile and very easy to work with.
Okay, the hanger, interesting. Now, there's not that much of it per cow, right?
No, very, very little.
Where does it come from on the cow?
It sits right inside. It's a muscle that aids in diaphragm movement.
Okay.
Inside the, so it sits right underneath the backbone. It just kind of hangs, which essentially the hanger steak, right underneath the backbone, about halfway back on the animal.
Mm-hmm. Give me another cut.
Oh wow.
One more.
Let's see.
What's your favorite?
We'll go to pork. Pork steak, a shoulder, Boston butt slice steak, probably my favorite, easily my favorite cut off of a hog. Very, very tender, excellent flavor profile, a lot of flavor with the marbling that's inside the shoulder, and a very, very good cut of meat.
Now, I wanted to ask who your most important man is on the floor during till days and cutting days. But before we get to that, maybe give us a weekly schedule that you guys have. I mean, a facility like yours, I mean, what are the week-to-week, you know, almost critical points, you know, in terms of staffing and your guys' work?
Well, on a week-to-week basis, there is 3 days of our week, Monday, Tuesday, and Friday, essentially, where we work on. I have three different rooms running. I have my slaughter floor running, my processing floor running, and my smoke packaging going.
Mm-hmm.
And then Wednesday and Thursday, essentially, is processing of heritage food pigs, where my entire staff is concentrating on cutting up 140 to 150 pigs in 2 days.
And who is your most important men on the floor, like, for the first day? Like, what happens on the first day versus the second day? I mean, do you do loins and shoulders the first day, and the second day you do, you know, shanks and hams, or how does that work?
Well, all of your hogs come in, starting out on usually Sunday evening. We'll get a drop off of hogs. Monday and Tuesday is slaughter, and it's usually about half and half. You know, we'll do about 75 on Monday and Tuesday. Wednesday goes into the first part of the process when everybody comes in first thing in the morning is getting all the heads off the carcasses. So all the heads are downed off the carcasses and into a container where they're brought out into the processing room, and all the cheek meat and the tongues are removed from the heads. And then all the jowls are worked up as well. So all your jowl that you sell is we separate your specialty orders of the skin on and the skinless and some of the different sized orders that we have and run all that stuff through. And then we start breaking down the carcasses into the primal cuts. Mm-hmm. Going into, you know, the shoulders, the Boston butts, the shanks, the loins, and each cut is broke down while the animal is broke down into primals. Mm-hmm. So as the loins or as the shoulders are broken off the carcass, the skin is removed. And then goes to the bandsaw where it's broken down into the Boston butts, the picnics, and the shanks. Right. The ribs and the loins are broken down. The bellies are set aside into a tub where I have another person filling belly orders, taking them to a mechanically skinning device or a mechanic skinning device, laying it on a belt. It runs through the skinner and de-skins it, or it goes straight into a cryovac bag with the skin on for other skin on orders. The loins are typically the skin is removed off the loin by hand with a knife and then passed to the person on the bandsaw who will then break it down into country ribs, 10 rib racks, whole center cut loins, whole loins, French racks, just depending on how many of those cuts you guys need for specific customers that week.
It takes a lot of precision to know exactly, you know, with all those hogs, like exactly where to cut it each time. I mean, like to guess a 12-ounce porterhouse versus a 14-ounce porter. I mean, it takes a fine eye, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, and it takes a lot of practice. And fortunately we have enough pieces of pork that come through on a weekly basis that we get a lot of practice in very quickly.
That's good. Practice is what gets you guys to Carnegie Hall for butchering.
Absolutely.
An experimental music thing. So let me ask, what is the who are your workers? Like, I mean, there's always this thing about, you know, Americans versus, you know, immigrant workers and all that. I mean, how have you found, what is the secret to being a good worker at Paradise Locker Meats? I mean, what characteristics do you need in an employee, and who are your main employees?
You know, what we look for when we're hiring into a new position or to an existing position of replacing someone, we're looking for people who are willing to work, because as you pointed out before, it is a labor intensive job, and there is a lot of moving and fast paced action that you need to keep up during the day. So that's one thing that we look for. We also look for somebody who's passionate about work and passionate about, has pride in what they do, because that's very, very important to us. As a custom slaughter facility, we have a lot of different requests from a lot of different people. So there's a lot of care that has to be taken in putting into everyday work, a lot of concentration to make sure that orders go out right and this customer is getting exactly what they wanted. So that's a big aspect of it too. They have to have pride in their work, and they have to care about what we're doing. It's very, very important to us that they feel like they're a part of our family, because as our family business, we want everyone to feel as involved as we are in what we're doing.
Those are just our fans in the audience applauding. Well, I've got to ask one more question, because I, during my move, lost all my Cutco knives Where do you buy your knives, and what knife company can you recommend for the layman out there like me?
Cutco is a great company. They stand behind their product. Personally, on a daily basis, the knives that we use are Forstner blades.
Okay.
They make an excellent, excellent knife. Very high-quality steel.
What's that company's name?
Forstner.
Forstner, okay.
Mm-hmm. And typically the handles that are made are Victor Knox handles. Mm-hmm. But Forstner steel is very, very good and holds up really well. You'll get a long-lasting knife from one of those.
Well, if I was a knife company, I would also want to stand behind my product just at the risk of not being stabbed standing in front of it. But anyway, Nick, it is very, very nice to have you. I'm hoping we actually have Brandon in the studio. I'm hoping that one of your guys' fundraisers can be Slaughterhouse-based, and we would get all the Slaughterhouse guys from around. So, Nick, thank you so much for being on. It's always eye-opening to hear you talk about your stuff, and we hope you come back on again.
Well, thank you for having me, Patrick. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Awesome. All right, I'll talk to you soon, Nick.
All right, bud. Have a good day. Without you,
so here we are back on the main course. I thought that was a fascinating interview with Nick Fantasma. I mean, he really, really, really broke it down. We are sponsored today by Franny's Restaurant. Nat, our engineer, Nat Wiener, do you want to do a little drop for Franny's to thank him?
I would love to. Today's main course is brought to you by Franny's and Brooklyn Larder, working hard to make the food in Brooklyn locally sourced, sustainable, and delicious. Find out more at franniesbrooklyn.com and at bklarder.com.
Franny's is definitely a legitimate pizza in this town. You know, like if you're going to do a test for your favorite pizza in the city, I mean, that one has to be part of the panel, I'm sure. Well, we're very, very happy to have Jody Williams and Rita Sodhi in studio. Welcome, guys.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can pull those closer to you. I actually confess, I did call Alice Waters this morning and be like, Jody's on. what question should I ask? So some of these questions are hers.
Okay. Cool.
Alice Waters, I know her favorite place in New York is Gotino. So I figured who better to ask.
Well, I'm all ears, so.
Where are you from originally?
I grew up in Northern California.
Yeah.
Lake Tahoe, Sacramento, San Francisco.
All right. And did you work there? I mean, is that where you broke into the industry, or did you just always kind of play with food and cook?
Always played with food, always cooked, you know, made my own lunches, but as a kid. But nope, I really New York. I started cooking in New York and mostly in Italy, 6 years in Italy. I left New York to learn how to cook. Just knocking on doors. Still learning how to cook. Still knocking on doors sometimes.
Still knocking on doors.
That's how I met Rita.
That's how you met Rita?
Yeah.
Knocking on doors? You opened?
No, she didn't knock on my door.
No, I knocked on her kitchen door to find out how she was doing her Italian food. So.
Oh, I see. And how do you do your Italian food, Rita?
Oh, it's all about my mother and my grow up. I grew up with my food.
You grew up with your food?
Yeah.
And are you Italian?
Yes, I'm Italian. I'm from Florence.
From Florence.
Yeah.
Is that city still Italian? Ogni tanto che vado lì a Florence vedo tanti americani, allora
tante Dio, facciamo in italiano questo.
Ah, anche tu, sì. Secondo me il producer non avrà dei problemi tagging in italiano. But I wanted to ask you one question. You have a tiny place, Judy. Oh my God, Jody. Jesus. Nah, I can't believe you made me do that.
Now you have to drink your Budweiser, so remember it's Jody.
Jody. Jody, it's a very small place, and you're there all the time. I mean, that's very unusual. I mean, how is it to be at your place all the time? I mean, it almost seems like in this day and age, many of my chef friends are like, oh, we run this great restaurant that we don't even have to be there anymore. You know, like that's how successful it is, and it seems to run contrary to the way you think and the way I would hope a restaurant would be run. So what is that like?
Oh, I don't know. For me, Gotino is it's my family. It's my home. It's, you know, it's my kitchen where I do my cooking, living, eating, and hanging out. And so it's sort of natural that I'm always there. You know, it's my life that I do. That.
And do you work now? Alice brought up this question, like, you know, people are always like, oh, you shouldn't work with your friends, you shouldn't mix pleasure with work and all that, and yet you are a very good friend, she says, with the various people that you work with.
Well, I wouldn't say friends, hopefully, but a great, I don't want to use the word boss, but, you know, I, you know, we've done this for a long time, and I understand my role for my employees at Gotino. You know, I'm a stepping stone to where they're going in life, and I look forward to that and appreciate that, and what they give me, I hope to give other people in return. So I want to be the boss I always worked for, but or didn't get it work for, but whatever.
You wanted to be the good. That's funny.
No, we really enjoy ourselves. If we don't like it, if we don't want to eat it or drink it, we don't want to do it. And likewise for the environment at Gotino, you know, it's just a small glass of wine with friends or a cup of coffee with friends in the morning.
In fact, I want to ask you about some of your morning people. I mean, to see people at that time, 8, 9 a.m., I mean, what is like that? Do you have your regular customers that kind of use that as a little third place to forget about things and read the paper? Or, like, what is your morning clientele like?
People reading the paper, people waking up, people have their seat, their corner, their, you know, where the sun comes, or their garden table. A lot of people come in for business meetings, or they want to do interviews, you know, it's just sort of, I think of it as sort of a piazza where everybody just uses it for whatever they need, but It's breakfast. People are eating a lot of food in the morning.
Really? Is that a big... I'm not a breakfast person. I'm more of a lunch or dinner person. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, breakfast is where a lot of people come to get their caloric intake.
Well, they get fresh squeezed oranges, or they have their coffee, or their second, third cup of coffee, and then eggs, and just some prosciutto or cheese. I'm surprised. They're mm-hmm. eating. I'm a little shocked.
They're big. Now, is it in Northern California, too? Breakfasts are big. Everyone wakes up so damn early over there.
Well, the breakfast itself, Gotino, is everything. Gotino's, I wouldn't say small, but I would say definitely on the, you know, it's not one of those huge Jack and Jill numbers, but it's all, I don't know.
It's all good, and the menu changes day to day or week to week. I mean, how?
No, in the morning we always run some specials that change maybe every 3 hours or something, but the menu's the same. You know, it's just steamed eggs and prosciutto and Parmesan, or eggs with pancetta and sage and butter, and you know, fresh squeezed orange juice. Just a few things. Actually.
Two things, and then at lunch, what happens?
Lunch, we'll do some sandwiches, a little panini.
Where do you
soup.
Get your bread from?
Oh, Rita gets her bread from the same guy. They're out here in Brooklyn, Royal Crown.
Royal Crown bread,
Royal Crown.
Huh?
I've used Royal Crown for over a decade. They have a coal-burning oven.
Mm. And what does that give the bread? What characteristics? Like burnt crust? Or?
A real savory, nice, crisp crust. I think it's some of the best example of Italian bread in the city.
Yeah, it's very rustic. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very like Tuscan bread. Like, you know, there is no like... it's just bread.
It's bread, but they have salt in their bread here. In the Tuscan bread, sometimes there's no salt.
No, there is no salt, yeah.
There's no salt in this one either.
No. In this one, there is.
Okay.
A little bit, yeah.
And it looks like it's not a focaccia. It's like the big bread with a lot of inside, or no? Is it small?
I have like a ciambella. It has the hole in the middle.
Oh, yeah, like a Tuscan donut.
Yeah, exactly. Bomboloni.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. And you use the same bread, the one with the hole in it?
No, I don't use the ciambella. I use ciabatta, filone, just bread, and get a lot of it.
And each sandwich requires a different bread. I mean, not each sandwich, but like depending on what you're putting into it affects the bread that you need for it, correct? Or is it the other
one? No, I'm plain Jane. Very simple. We have one bread, the filoni, and we slice it, and we use it for all our sandwiches, or salami, a pecorino, or the one other bread we use would be the pancare, the white bread, and we make a toasted prosciutto with that.
Wow, we actually have a call-in. So let us ask. Hey, caller in her, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Oh, hello. How are you?
Yeah, this is Brian Kenny calling from... Overcast Alameda, California.
Oh, nice. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Hey, I'm enjoying the show. I'm a lover of eggs, especially poached eggs. And I wondered why more people don't put those on their menu. Is it a pain in the rear to cook on a production level or what?
Yeah, poached egg. You get one chance to get that egg right. And the timing, and then it's fragile, and you got to carry it over to the plate and hand it to a waiter, and it's got to get to your table. So without doing something like putting it in a water bath or torturing the egg to, you know, to end up on your salad or whatnot, they take a little bit of care, but it's really simple. We use actually a egg poacher that is you'd find in any domestic kitchen, and it works really well.
Interesting. Oh, so what do you have to get just right with the poached egg? Like, you have to pull it out of being cooked right at that right second?
You want that runny, beautiful middle, and you want the whites to be firm and delicate, so the timing's on. Another 10 or 18 seconds, you'll get that jelly middle.
And you won't know until the diner actually.
Oh, no. I think most cooks know when their egg is a little over or under. Yeah.
Even without having
they
to
They might
break
not
it.
Pay attention to it, but yeah, no. You know when the egg is on, when it's good egg or not.
So you would say, great question caller. So you would say the answer to it is the sheer difficulty, the small margin of error for being able to get that dish right.
Yeah, I think that might be it.
Interesting. I like that there's still certain things that remain the domain of the artisanal, you know, small business, you know, that other people can't co-opt. Well, I mean, let's get back to that, and then I want to get to dinner and how that you're open. But, well, let's ask that about dinner, just to keep a common thread. So dinner. So you go from the eggs, the poached eggs, to the sandwiches, and then how do you turn this tide towards, you know, the dinner, the end, last meal of the day?
Well, Gotino being open from 8 a.m. to 2 a.m., we sort of think of the meal periods as morning, afternoon, and evening. Mm-hmm. And so when we get to evening, because I'm not a restaurant, so dinner sort of means I'm a restaurant. Now, Rita's a restaurant. I'm just a... I'm an enotech in a real traditional sense. So you can have a little, you can have a lot. But in the evening, we start serving more of some Tennessee ham sliced by hand, or prosciuttos and cheeses. We do little rabbit pot pies, usually about six meats, six fishes, six little vegetables, beets that are cooked in cartocho, they're baked in paper. So we have a really big menu, because we like to cook a lot over there. And maybe we'll bake, serve Nutella. We have great ice cream out of Philadelphia, and it's a lot of wine drinking. So, and every dish is meant to, is sized to go with a glass of wine.
So yeah, it's all smaller dishes, right? You don't have that big 32-ounce main course of anything.
No, and you know what? Gotino is, it's not really a restaurant, but people use it like a restaurant, or they use it like a bar. So it's like I said, it could be your indoor picnic, your outdoor picnic, or whatever you need.
And what is the, and I want to ask, then I'm going to ask Rita some questions about her restaurant, but I mean, just to get back to this issue, I mean, what is the, this slow life? Alice said that you live the slow life, you know, which is the highest compliment, you know, that you can get, you know, from her. But what is that? I mean, what is the life of someone who lives at their place of work, you know, where work and, you know, where the fulfillment of the actual workplace is enough to make someone happy and fascinated and keep them alert and stimulated. I mean, most people don't have that luxury. So can you unpack a little bit what it means to live at your work?
Well, I don't know. I don't want to sound corny, but, you know, it's like it's a dream. You know, what do we want to do today? We are working at ilovegotino.com. It's a little online magazine about food, wine, and design. We knock out some ideas about that. You know, it's a lot. It has a lot to do with community. And being located in the West Village is, you know, people coming in the doors. I don't know how to answer this question. I'm much better making eggs than being on the radio, Patrick. But
what could you cook your answer for me? Maybe next time you're like, this is the answer.
Yeah, that would probably be easier. It's just. I'm just there making sure everybody's in and out, and, you know, cooking some dinners. Thinking about, it's sort of like we sit around. What do you want to do today? Let's do a bread, a brown butter bread pudding, or bread stuffing with pig's feet. Porcini. No porcini right now. It's a lot like play.
Right, absolutely.
And it's a lot like play, and there's a sense of there's a passion at Gotino about what we're doing. And customers come in, and it's just, I'm really lucky to have great people that enjoy Gotino and contribute. Tell me what they want to eat. All right, tomorrow lentil soup. Come back at 3. I would say a sense of community sort of slows it down. It's I'm a business owner, so it is a business. But the business is all about getting people to find something they love there. So, you know, if I'm enjoying it, someone else might enjoy it too.
Exactly, you know? Exactly. Now, Rita, tell me about your restaurant. Where is it located? And describe the food that comes out of your restaurant.
Oh, my restaurant is in the West Village. And the name is Isodi, and is in Christopher, 105 Christopher Street.
Which is where? It's right off of Hudson?
Between Bleecker and Hudson.
Okay.
And my food is the food of my mother, where I grew up with, so I'm very familiar. And my restaurant is my house, is my kitchen, is my, and everybody come in is like my guest. And it's very simple, nothing fancy. It's all about ingredients and seasonal. That's it.
And the cooking is mainly, so it's funny, you have a lot in common. Your cuisine is mainly from central Italy?
Yeah, yes, from Tuscany.
From Tuscany.
Yeah.
And how many people, you're open for lunch and dinner?
No, I'm just open for dinner.
For dinner.
Yeah.
And because it's such a home type of environment, what are the types of qualities that you have found in your workers? Like, what is an important characteristic that the people who are technically in your home, you know, in this place that you've spent so much time.
I treat everybody, they are a part of my family, and I care about them, and hopefully they care about me. So it's all about...
How could they not?
Hopefully. And so it's the environment. I'm trying, you know, it's a big experience for me, this, and I try to mix my culture with everybody other culture, and you know, and see what's happened.
Are the base foundational ingredients the same? Like, even when you have people from different cultures, do they still use wheat, and do they still have a polenta type or a dumpling? I mean, is it all the same grammar, just put together in different ways?
Yeah, I think everybody has culture. They have to understand, you know, okay, I think that the most important thing is that they love food.
Mm-hmm.
If you love food, you will love my food, because it's so simple that, you know, and taste right what you put inside. So there is no like nothing around that. It's just about ingredients. And if you put beans, it tastes like beans. Doesn't mm-hmm. taste like cream and beans and something like that. It's just beans.
Mm-hmm.
So if you like food, you like to work in my on my food.
Right. So it's big ingredient-based, obviously, because, I mean, you're really putting the dish out and minimizing your effect, which, of course, if you love food, you know that that's the greatest yeah. art of all, is to have a light touch, but still one that brings out the best of the ingredient.
I started eating Rita's restaurant at East Sodi, and when the spinach, I started with the sautéed spinach, I had to know who cooked this, because it was right on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we developed our friendship, but, you know... She's the original, of course, from Firenze. I'm the American making Italian food. So.
And now, American making Italian food is a big challenge. I mean, it's just practice, right? It's the more you go out, the more you taste, the more you know what... Because my mother always says that there is a right and a wrong when it comes to taste. And that's not the most popular thing to say. And you can like something that's wrong, but there is still truth when it comes to gastronomy, you know, and how did you learn that as an American?
I went to the source. You know, the best way to learn cooking is go to the source. If it's Parmigiano, Reggio Emilia. If it's prosciutto, you're interested, Langriano. So working in real Italian kitchen with, you know, in Rome and Reggio Emilia, you learn. You learn that slow food method. There's mm-hmm. there's a lot of other ways, but basically that's it. Like in Rita's, her mother cooking
mm-hmm.
for large groups all her life.
Is your mother still around? Does she?
Yeah, she's still around. She's not cooking anymore.
Okay.
But she's still around. She came last year when I opened for a week. She stayed in the kitchen for 10 days, actually. Check everything I was doing. And
that's
everything.
Actually a short amount of time yeah. for an Italian mother to come. It's usually like yeah. 5 weeks or something.
Yeah. But
does she like what you do? Does yeah, she criticize it?
No, she was very proud of me, I think. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
And, I should take a quick station break now. You want to thank Franny's one more time? We're produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Rec Tech.
Who says
Nat Wiener.
That this show is brought to you by Franny's in Brooklyn Larder, working hard to make the food in Brooklyn locally sourced, sustainable, and delicious. Find out more at franniesbrooklyn.com and bklarder.com.
Love Franny's.
Well, if a voice could have the word butter associated with it, Nat, it would be for your voice. Your voice is pure butter. So we're going to take a 30-second break, and we will come back with Jody Williams and Rita Sodi. We'll be right back.
yourself up in your house. Okay, teacher, you have a just about spirit within you. You have a spirit of greed. You have a spirit of destruction.
This is a very interesting episode of the main course. I think there have been a lot of people who've been listening to us and going like this. That's how interesting we are. So I had just found something interesting. Supposedly, Jody does not cook with the kitchen and Rita does. What does that mean? Who doesn't cook with the kitchen? Doesn't everyone cook in the kitchen? What's going on?
Well, I got an electric stove. And do just about everything in the morning off my espresso machine, from steaming eggs to like steaming up soups and things like that. So I have this, I have a menu that works around this limited facility, but it's a pleasure.
You don't have a back area. Everything is right in front in that bar zone, right?
Everything is right at front, except for downstairs we have a little electric stove and a little prep table, and it's just all by hand and. Or what you can do on there. So,
So you cook basically without a kitchen. This place, Roberta's, where we're at, Carlo used to cook without any amenities, and I always said he was the best guy to invite camping because he could cook for 300 people, no problem, you know, in the middle of a forest. But now you cook more with a traditional kitchen.
Yeah, I'm a basic person. I need a kitchen. She's an artist. I'm a basic one. So
thank you.
I need to do my sauce for 4 hours. So I need a kitchen to do that. She's an artist. She makes her egg from the steam and the coffee machine and everything. So it's another job.
So Rita, how would you describe Jody's art? Like, it's to make use of less, or is it to find different ways of doing things, or is it understanding the food?
Yeah, she understands very well the Italian food. She has amazing taste, and she knows so well what she's doing, then she finds different way to do it.
Mm-hmm. She can find a different way. She can cook something with steam rather than
in when
the
she
oven.
Told me, you know, when I met her and she said, "Oh, come on, you have steam eggs? What is that? I want scrambled eggs. I don't want steam eggs, you know." Like, and she was, "Okay, give me one, okay?" And they are fantastic. Mm-hmm. Every time I go there, I have my steam eggs with prosciutto and Parmigiano cheese, you know?
Isn't it nice? I mean, I think too often this country, America, rewards new things and doesn't so much honor the things that remain consistent and of high quality. So it's nice to go to the same place and know you can get something that's like a 10 all the time. And you don't need to mess with that. And just because it has jalapeno peppers in it one day, it doesn't make it better, you know?
It can be the same thing
all the time.
Yeah, that's... I love doing things by hand too in my kitchen. You know, whether it's a mortar and pestle or like a coffee grinders. We have for we do different coffees for French press, whatnot. But as much as we can do by hand, it's a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And the benefit is, I don't need any electricity. Like the Burkle, the slicing, it's not plugged in. It's a real acoustic kitchen, so to speak, you know.
Yeah, because you're doing everything right there, and people are reading their papers, so it has to be quiet as well.
Yeah, I used to joke, by the time I got around to opening my own restaurant, I'd have to do it on an espresso machine. And lo and behold, we're, you know. But we do things. We make a lot of terrines, a wild boar terrine, and we do a really beautiful Copa di Aia, which is a Ballantine. And I got this idea, Rita does a pasta dish that is, what was it, a Verona and quail and rabbit meat. So it's like Bianco.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that would make a great idea for... a terrine, and with Jenny Roby, one of my cooks there, we did this great Ballantine for all these meats. So we do some little more sophisticated thing, but it's all simple stuff.
Now, you used to work in a school. I mean, you were a lunch lady. I mean,
yeah, I was a lunch kid. I was one of those kids that was pulled out of like reading class in sixth grade to go serve lunch. Work for your education and serve lunches. So, but I was quite adept. I could do peaches with one hand and peas with the other.
And slop them on.
There we'd go. But no hairnet.
No hairnet.
No.
I keep my friend Mona Talbot is a friend of Alice Waters's, and I always say she deserves like a golden hairnet. You know,
I know world. Mona.
Yeah.
And Rita knows Mona from Italy.
Oh, really?
Such a small world.
Right, in Rome?
She came in Florence and we had lunch together.
She's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
She did so many interesting things, but I mean, her pioneering work in the schools and, you know, someone of her talent going into, now I was saying the lunch ladies are also very talented because they have $2.50 to work with per meal for the kids. I mean, you know, they've had to be iron chefs in their own right, you know, with that type of budget to feed the public school system. So, this whole idea of getting restaurants paired with the lunch ladies, I think, is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it'd be great for the restaurant, too, you know, to always play a bigger role in the community. I don't know, what are Italian lunches like?
Oh, Italian
as a kid?
Lunch? Oh, for kids, normally for lunch, I can tell about my mother, what she did to me, because now I lost a little bit, like, touch with the new generation. Was normally pasta.
Even in schools, they made pasta.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wild.
You know, there's somebody in Italy that if you don't have pasta, they feel like they didn't eat.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't really count.
I didn't have pasta, so I didn't eat it today. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Jody, the only risk of bringing you on into this program is you would get there an hour early and get rid of all the equipment. And then once you left, you're like, no, now we just have a little steamer and that's it. We'll cook for 600 people. No, but very, very interesting. And I one of the last questions I wanted to ask, because I know there's a lot of young people that listen to the, you know, radio and do searches, you know, trying to find out about what they're going to do in life. And so what are the challenges of running a business in, you know, the West Village? Basically, both of you are right in that kind of area. I mean, it's got to be one of the most competitive markets in the world for a restaurant. And how do you guys do it? And what are the big challenges? And what advice would you give our listeners?
That's it. That's a great question. I think in life, generally, it's do what you love, focus on the activity, the product, or the idea, and just, you don't, you know, as long as you're trying to accomplish, in my case, this Gotino, this idea of a nonstop Enoteca, just building it. It's constant vigilance and calling up, you know, repair or this or staffing or food sourcing and cooking and training. But if you love it, it's easy, you know. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, I think it has to be love.
Okay.
and know what you want to do. You have to know very well what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And be sure that you can do it. At that time when you have this, you know, these two things together, you can go and try.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's up to the moment, it's up to a lot of things. But if you believe in what you know, in what you believe.
Yeah, it's like you get these ideas and so execute it. Yeah. Fulfill that vision. It might take 3 years or starting over, but not giving up. Or you know, running into and, you know, complications and reinventing it and stuff. But it's still the same vision and the same mm-hmm. tastes. And
it's always nice to bring back everything that you experience into one vision. Because if you go with every opportunity and every new idea, you go crazy and nothing is that good. Mm-hmm. But if everything is always brought back,
yeah, you have to focus in one thing, in what you really believe,
and go down with that ship.
Yeah,
even if it's not, you know, you fail. At least you fail having done what you thought.
Yeah, and you know where you fell.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think, you know, your character and a good sense, like a little philosophy that you, something you really believe in. When you have convictions, it will aid in accomplishing a lot of things in life.
Exactly.
You know.
I had a great friend of mine once said, you know, that he was in a band when he was in his 20s, and for 40, 50, he's now 50, so it's been 30 years, mm-hmm. and his band broke up. And I was like, how sad that your band doesn't tour anymore. And he's like, no, it's not sad anymore, because I know in my heart and in my brain that I can still play. So it doesn't matter whether or not I get the call and have to perform. What matters is that I am able. And I thought that was a very empowering kind of life.
That's beautiful. I mean, that's how I feel. I mean, for me, learning how to cook was a journey. Mm-hmm. And now that I'm a business owner, that's another journey and a job. But I'm really fond, nostalgic for the journey of learning how to get where I am now.
Mm-hmm, that absolutely. Was great. Well, this has been a hot show. This has been absolutely great. We did from slaughterhouse world to the meatpacking district. We did the whole spectrum and everything in between. So thank you so much. I hope you ladies will come back. And
would love to. Roberta's is great. And you're fantastic.
Thank you.
And we'll do, and you know, Roberta's, I hope you're staying for lunch, because I'd love to hear what you think of their delicious food.
Yeah, we will.
Awesome. Well, we will be back next week with my co-host Katie Kiefer, engineered by Nat Wiener, produced by Jack Inslee. And if it's Sunday, it's the main course. Thanks to Franny's for sponsoring us.
You are really...